The Muskie 360 Podcast is brought to you by Yeti, built for the wild, Evinrude E-Tech Outboards, Joe Bucher Outdoors, the number one name in Big Fish products, and The Muskie Shop.
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 Podcast, post-holiday edition here. We're sitting here on New Year's Day. I've got my friend Josh Krieger on the phone from Wallhanger Guide Service. How you doing, Josh?
Good. How's it going, Steve? How were the holidays?
They were good. It was insanely warm. I talked to you before we started the podcast. It has been in the 70s in Tennessee this week.
Yeah, that's
post-Christmas. I'm out fishing in shorts and a t-shirt. It's 75 degrees one afternoon here. It's crazy. The weather right now is absolutely crazy. I know I talked to you and I talked to Booker today. You guys have just had nasty winterish mix. You know, you got snow, you got rain. It's wild. But down here, it is warm. And it has been warm. We're taking a turn, you know, for a little bit chillier stuff. But around the holidays, just really shockingly warm stuff, which brings us into what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk southern muskie fishing.
And sounds good, yeah.
There's nothing better to sort of sum that up of, hey, it's the week of Christmas and leading up to New Year's, and you can be outside in a t-shirt. That really will help you kick the winter blues.
Absolutely, yes, it would.
You know, and you'll be down here with me here shortly. And for those that don't know, I'm really bad about this on the podcast. Joe's actually said to me, I really don't talk about me, and I'm going to not try to sit there and do it. But for those that don't know, I guide professionally here in Tennessee. I'm a full-time guide. And so southern muskies are 99% of my time. I guide throughout Tennessee, spent time in Kentucky. We have a cabin on Cave Run, so I've got tons and tons of days on Cave Run. Grew up in West Virginia. So southern muskies are my bread and butter. And, you know, each year I go up and fish on Eagle for an extended amount of time. But the rest of the year, I'm in the South, and this is just where my head lives and my thought process is. And what I thought would be interesting is, Josh, you are in northern Wisconsin.
Yep, yeah.
And so you're fishing what? Around Eagle River, St. Germain, sort of the normal haunts, right? Sort of that's your running territory, or?
Yep, yeah. I mean, Vilas, Oneida counties, I mean, kind of lakes all over in there. Right. But, yeah, and specifically, yeah, like, Eagle River chain, I fish a lot just because I work at a marina right on the Eagle River chain as well. So
yeah, and the reason, like, it's perfect for to have you on the podcast, the vast majority of time you spend is in that primary muskie location, but every year you're cool enough, you come down and me and you spend some time on the boat. So I thought it'd be a neat perspective to have, you know, sort of your thoughts on what's different, you know, and it's shockingly different at times, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it can be, for sure. I mean, it is muskie fishing, so there are some similar patterns and some similar things you look for, but, yeah, I know, I mean, just what you're fishing is a lot different. I mean, it's all big reservoirs. Up here, I mean, a big lake for most people up here is 1,000 acres, and, I mean, that's tiny down there.
Yeah,
you know?
The first time I remember we were on the boat, and you're like, you know, how big is it? It's Melton Hill. And it's like, if you go dam to dam, if you go to the dam above, it's huge. We're miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. And a lot of people, the first time they step on my boat, are shocked by the enormity.
Oh, I was. I mean, the first day that I truly was on Melton Hill, this is actually before I even met you.
Yeah.
I was down there because me and my buddy, when we were down there, I think we met you like the third day we were down there.
Yeah.
And yeah, this was like the first day we went down there. We traveled 20 miles just in the first day, just exploring, seeing kind of what the water had, you know,
right,
and what we could maybe expect. And, I mean, it kind of kicked our butts a little bit. It's
surprising.
It can be tough. It's a lot.
Yeah. Look, you know, that's the thing is often, you know, people will call me and they want advice or they want to talk about stuff. And they look at these reservoirs on a map. You're looking at a physical map or on Google Maps, you know, how we do everything. Now you're pulling it up on your computer. And it just really doesn't convey the size. And,
not,
and
not at all.
Not at all.
Not at
you,
all.
I mean, I think about like Cave Run. You know, you can get on Cave Run, and it's huge. You know, there's just there's spots on Cave Run I have never fished. I've been fishing on Cave Run since I was 10 years old. And, you know, there's just areas where it's like haven't spent any time there because it's a lot of water. Same way with here in Tennessee. You can talk about some other reservoirs that are just ginormous, Del Hollow, North, that are just monstrous Canadian-esque size bodies of water. And if you start thinking about it, it's a little disconcerting. Like you said, if you're coming from Three Lakes Chain, Evil River, you're doing the Fox Chain, and you step onto these just here's the big stage. You know?
So, oh yeah. I mean, I checked out even when I was down there, the Rock Island area. I mean, mm-hmm. it's the water's so much deeper than it is up here too. Like most of our lakes aren't even that deep. I mean, the Eagle River chain, well, specifically the Eagle River chain.
Right.
So just the 10 lakes that are in the town of Eagle River, not the 18 on the three right, lakes. Right. That's technically all on chain. But yeah, so just the Eagle River chain. I mean, the biggest lake is, I think, like 1,200 acres. And then the deepest spot on any of the lakes, like maybe touches 30 feet.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just down there. I remember seeing, I mean, 20 feet from shore sometimes, you're down in 60 feet of water.
Oh, yeah, you can find deep water. And there's some other spots and other lakes that it's just like, you know, we start going over to the Western Slope there in North Carolina. They're crazy deep. Fontana. There's some other bodies of water where you go, you know, it's not uncommon. 50, 60, you know, you've got some, not what I call big water, but you got deep water. And it will skew the patterning. And those fish, you know, at times they're using that, whether they're stage pelagic out over it, you know, or pursuing bait. And it can sort of skew things and sort of throw you off your game. And that's like one thing to talk about on the podcast is, you know, if somebody's coming down and they've never fished in the South, let's say this 2020 is the year they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, I am sick of the snow. I'm getting out of here. Let's go fish it.
That's what took me down there right. In the first place. Yep.
And you go to shake the winter blues. And if you don't really have a game plan or a thought process in place, you can just come down here and get your butt whipped.
And I think
that's one thing people don't realize is it can send you home brokenhearted real fast. You know, Cave Run's got great numbers and all that stuff. Tennessee, what I would say is we've got crazy good size class, but not high population density. And it's just a different ball game where you have a small population of fish using a small area on a massive body of water. You know, that really, if you don't know the spot. And so that's one thing to consider. You know, things that I can think of off the top of my head, if like, let's say you're a northern angler and you're coming down here to make that transition, it's common, but is downsizing. And that's, I think, primarily based on the forage base. You've been on the boat with me where you can hit I just call it a shad slick, where you'll hit schools of shad that are just seemingly never endless.
Mm-hmm.
And so when your forage base is in that 3 to 5 inch range, you know, and the fish are feeding on that over the course of the winter or something, it's sometimes a hard sell with a 12 inch crankbait.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of that classic thing. Everybody sort of knows the southern rattle trap stuff post spawn. And one thing you got to be cognizant of when you're pursuing muskies on a southern body of water is matching the hatch to some degree. So, you know, there's times where you want to go big, but at least being in that size realm of what the they're feeding on at that time, so you're not throwing out something that is way too much shock and all.
It's so different. I mean, as far as the bait goes, it's so different down there. I literally have baits in my box that I bought specifically just for Tennessee.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because I've been down there and I know the bait's different, and I've caught fish on these colors that I don't even necessarily use up here. Colors are always the most important, but I mean, with the presentation, you know, the size and the color and the time of the year, put it all together. And if you have success, why
change go somewhere else? And that's one thing I talk about often is, you know, what I take when I'm going to fish on Eagle is not what I'm using here. You know,
oh, right.
But on the same token, not to oversell that point, you've been with me where it's like 12-inch suic bite and clobbering monsters, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And also, too, you've seen it where we're fishing super slow, twitching 5-inch shallow raiders and just latching into big fish. And, mm-hmm. and you know, for those that are listening, we're not talking about the spring. We're not talking March, April, May, June. We're talking January, February.
Oh, yeah. Winter. Cold weather. Yeah.
And sometimes, and I'll have to put a picture on the podcast of me and you in t-shirts a couple years ago. You know, here it is February. Yeah. We're sending
pictures. Oh, yeah. We had that fog, too. That really crazy mm-hmm. fog bearing on the water that morning. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you'll have little Indian summers and ebbs and flows in this where you can get those warm days. But, you know, you're going to have to sort of study your body of water and observe. I think that's the biggest thing that you got to think about when you're coming into a southern situation is observe what's going on. If the shad are up high and they're easy pickings for muskies, that's when I'm thinking 5-inch shallow raiders. I'm thinking small twitch baits. You know, right. and like I said, that pattern's emerged with us. I think, what do we have? Was that a 4-fish day? I think.
And
you lost a monster that just out of nowhere smashed it. And so,
yeah, I think we were doing pretty well that morning. And someone asked me what I was catching the fish on, and he switched to a bait fairly similar.
Who, me? Never. I would absolutely never cherry pick. What are you talking about?
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. You know, I'm just.
Oh, I did.
You know, the northern guy goes down there, and I mean, not that, you know, obviously going down there in the past helped, fishing with you, but yeah, I go down there, I kind of got on a hot bite with a certain bait, and then all of a sudden Steve's like, oh, what are you getting them on? And then you went and caught what, 2 or 3 or something like that.
It
right?
was stupid, but it was the
it was, yeah.
Well, what it was too, and it's sort of something Joe talks about all the time, and not to get too off topic, but that is a perfect example of tinkering with baits and having them dialed in. Because the one thing, and I'm not going to name names, we're not going to pick on anybody, our good friend that was with us and he wasn't connecting didn't have a shallow raider that suspended like the two that we had.
No, yeah.
And remember, it was just a matter of twitch, somewhat suspended, extremely slow rise, and it was just, you know, it was game on Donkey Kong is what it was after that. Because,
I
think about that in the aspect that that's just a great example. Like I said, whether you can be in Canada, it doesn't matter where you're at, but finding that tweak, finding the bait that is just tailor-made for your situation. Sometimes you stumble into it like we did that trip, and sometimes it's designed, you know, it's of your design. You're sitting there adding weight to these baits or augmenting the hooks or something to get that action out of them. But that just a perfect example of a crazy dialed-in day. Another thing to consider, though, too, is if you look at it seasonally, and I guess talking about patterning, obviously the warm-ups of the Indian summers and all this come into play, but mm-hmm. you and I have also done southern trips where it is nothing but banging big rubber deep.
Yep. You're not right yet.
And we're talking same time frame. We're talking winter here. So on one hand, we have a shallow water pattern that would resemble something you would do in the spring in the north. And then one year elapses, we have different conditions, and the only way you're going to get a strike is the slowest rubber presentation you've ever seen, where the fishing is just so boring it's like watching paint dry.
<You know? laughs> Oh yeah, I know. Yeah.
But that's the same thing, though, as if you're dialed in on that trip as well. I think we had a couple multiple fish days, I think. But,
oh yeah, topped off with your 47.5, which was that was a pretty nice fish.
Yeah, that'll do, pig. That will do. So I guess what I'm getting at overall to think about is don't come down with the preconceived notion if you're gonna fish the south that it's all downsized all the time. But be prepared to do that. And be prepared to do the homework on the patterning. I think that goes with anywhere that you're fishing. One thing, though, to point out, like you said, you already said, we're talking about the size of these reservoirs. We're talking about the locational differences based on conditions, which is just commonplace to think about. But we'd be remiss to not sort of talk about the structure of these bodies of water. And I think that might be the scariest thing for somebody that's uninitiated in southern muskie fishing. When we start talking, you could give a dissertation on structure fishing from one
day. Just everything.
Everything.
I remember the one spot that I really, really thought I liked and looked really, really good. When we talked to you later, you told me you had fished hours and hours on it. It was Gilligan's Point because you never seen a fish on it. And the worst part is we fished that spot with a giant storm coming in, and right. I'm throwing a big shallow invader, and I get absolutely rocked, and I set the hook, and I'm like, yeah, I got one. You know, it looks like a perfect big fish spot.
Yeah.
Huge storm rolling in. It was like a 13-inch largemouth.
Yeah.
I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah. So
Gilligan's Point. The other one is, yep. I think I've shown you, I call it Canadian Rocks,
mm-hmm.
which are those rocks that, and I've run into it multiple times. It's a rock formation that if you don't look at anything around, if you look at the rocks, you go, I'm on Lake of the Woods. You go, that is like a Lake of the Woods rock formation. Holy crap. You know, and I've seen it. I call it Canadian Rocks because I'll see boats casting to it, and I just go, there's nothing here that looks familiar. That's the first thing that's registered with them, and they're going to just pound on it to no mm-hmm. avail. Right. That's another thing like Gilligan. And you said Gilligan's Point. That is just truly one of those places that looks good but doesn't hold fish.
I don't understand why it wouldn't. It's
too long of a podcast for that one. But
I
could tell you why, but I don't want to give that one out. But the Canadian Rocks, the spot I call that as well, is just another one of those places where on paper it looks exceptionally good. It's got all the elements that you're looking for, but you know, I've seen a fish and pulled a fish off of it a time or two, but it's not a high producer. And I think what structurally will confuse you or you'll find shocking if you're first time in the South is the amount of plunging breaks and the amount or the degree of complexity where, and one thing that I point out often to people is most of these southern reservoirs don't have what I would call a Canadian-esque or northern-style cove.
Not really.
You're not going to pull in, and here we've got this, you know, what's an average cove size? 50, 60 yards, some manageable size thing. The complexity and the enormity of things are what can be confusing at times, because if you're looking for these visual elements, you know, and I've done it numerous times, you got on a new body of water, you drive around for a little bit and you go, that looks good. And what's on the surface rarely belies what lies beneath here.
Right.
And like you're saying with Gilligan's Point, the problem with Gilligan's Point, I'll just say it is what it is, because nobody knows what I'm talking about. The problem with Gilligan's Point is that point is not attached to anything structurally that leads to deep water. And it sort of gives the fish a way to move in and out of it.
Okay, yeah.
And so it breaks up very hard. It's a hard break, you know, hundreds of yards from it, but there's no channel or anything. So you just have this immense flat, and the fish are going, where's the highway? And one thing that I would encourage people to do if you're coming down south is to study structural maps and look at, okay, where are the routes? How are the fish actually going to traverse this body of water? Because if you get the plank or some other spots I've shown you at, these enormous flats where it's hundreds and hundreds of yards of either weed growth or just sand during the winter, where there's only certain places that the fish are using because the rest of it, there's no highway leading in and out of. You know, right. So they're not arbitrarily going to come up and go, hey, I'm going to swim over to this stump because it's over here.
Right.
When there's other things that are road markers for them. And I think, you know, we're getting into just that thought process of structure fishing, which I preach on nonstop. And if you've not spent any time studying what Joe's talked about, and a lot of that stuff comes from Buck Perry and a lot of these other anglers that are looking at the structural elements of a lake, sort of discerning how and why a fish goes places, comes into play. I mean, Another spot I would bring up is there's a very large embayment that you fish with me, and then right across on the other side, another embayment that doesn't produce. And a lot of that is just based upon one side of the reservoir. There are channels and creeks leading in and out of this spot that allow the fish to navigate, where the other is flooded and it really doesn't have that structural element. And I don't think we can overstate how structurally oriented it is, though. You know, overall, opposed to if you're coming from like bowl-shaped lakes up north, would you agree with that? Sort of like that it can be a little bit daunting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of everything. I mean, I remember even Cave Run, I was out there, and mm-hmm. we were in 30 feet of water with trees, like, up above the water line. And, I mean, yeah. you don't see anything like that up here. Like I said, I mean, the deepest the lake even gets is 30 feet on the Eagle River chain for the most part. So,
and I know you know the answer to this, though. You know what the fun part of fishing Cave Run is? The getters is what I call them. That one will get you. That's a getter, boy. And you'll see a boat just run his skeg or his prop into a piece of standing timber out in 20 feet of water.
Yep.
Back in the day, in my younger years, I will say this, you know, there's a lot of that stuff has been either banged down by somebody or broken away over the years. But when that place was even younger, it was even more atrocious, you know, as far as the standing timber. And that's one thing down here further south. It seems like there was less standing timber that got flooded, you know, in Tennessee and most of these places. There are standing timber, but not like you're talking about.
Cave Run is crazy.
If you've never fished, if you're listening to this and you haven't fished Cave Run, it's worth the time. It's obviously a well-known body of water, and it's just different. I mean, you look at the standing timber patterns you can get into there, vertical jigging on that timber, casting it around that stuff.
You can catch them off of washers and dryers.
Milk jugs.
They're not the cleanest water, but they're definitely fish to be caught, dumping their dumpster
right there beside, hey, you catching anything? Let me dump this dump truck full of shit in the lake. You know, that seems to be the common occurrence. Yeah. Call it. You know, I will say this, they've done a real good job of cleaning that up. We used to all the time just get so perturbed of the Clorox bottles. I used to call it a Kentucky seagull, right?
Oh yeah. I saw a couple of those. Yeah,
they'd have a jug of Clorox, an empty jug as a jug line out there, and here they are floating around in your 100 yards from them, and you look at it and go, that looks like, is that a seagull or is that a bird sitting there? No, it's just somebody's jug. But, you know, admittedly so, here in the South, we have cleaned up our act. Thank you very much. We've cleaned it up. Tennessee's beautiful. We dump money into it.
The
one thing, too, if you're talking South, and I can't neglect my homeland, West by God, Virginia, Mountain Mama, yeah. Country Roads, whatever you want to do there, is a phenomenal fishery. And that's one thing that it gets overlooked in a lot of aspects, but you get into some stellar waterways in West Virginia. Stone Call, tons of rivers, and that's one thing, too, we should talk about. There's a lot of river fishing in the South.
Oh, yeah.
You've done it with me where you can get on, you know, it's John Boatable size rivers and creeks and stuff where you can get into some serious size class fish. I know me and you have done river fishing before and done really well with it. You know, like I said, you get into West Virginia, you've got some just serious fisheries that are well stocked, and a lot of them have killer native populations to boot, and they're just absolutely beautiful. Some of the mountainous stuff is going to be a little bit colder, but I'm thinking off the top of my head, you know, you can go, goodness,
North Carolina. I haven't been there, but I've heard good things, you know,
and it's right, you know, right over the border from me. Lower density, you've got, I'm just thinking Southern, so put ideas in people's heads as places you could eat people you've never even thought of. An interesting one is, around Asheville, which admittedly I've not fished that stretch. They call it the Muskie Mile, but right there in Asheville, there's a stretch that's producing good fish. that is just something most muskie anglers never even registers. North Carolina, like what? A little known factoid. A couple years ago, a guy caught, I think, as a 42 or a 43 in South Carolina.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if that thing swam down. I'm guessing it did. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. Right, it's right, a little warm, but I'm sitting there going, eh. You know, I don't think it's fishable, but it popped in my head. And that reminds me, I'll just have to, next time you're down here in a couple of weeks, we'll probably drive over the hill there. And so you can go check out North Carolina. But, you know, it's interesting to look at how many bodies of water here. I know here in Tennessee, you know, all the way over to Central Tennessee, you've got a lot of water. I mean, just a lot of opportunities here for fishing. And like we've been discussing, the changes that you need to make are not insurmountable, though. Because like you said, there's some lures that are just transcendent and they're just going to catch muskies, period.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a 6-inch shallow raider definitely works up here and it definitely works down there.
Right. Or a depth raider or you know, a top raider. We get into, our buddy Spencer that one trip just laid the wood to us with a Burt. You know? Yep. Really? You're fishing with a Burt? It's February. Yep. Put that thing away. And he's just laying the wood to us. So it's not like you have to, if you're thinking about a trip down here, you don't have to go and like re-gear everything. I'm trying to think, what are some stuff, and I don't want to skew your answer because I do this every day down here. What are some baits that you're going, okay, if I'm going down south, I gotta have this?
Well, I mean, like this time of year, well, it's funny you ask because, so obviously I'm going down there here at the end of the month and I just was thinking to myself here in the last couple of days, I'm like, all right, I got to organize all my musky stuff here, you know, from fall.
knock the dust off.
Well, right, too. But I kind of, you know, I change because I only usually take like one box. I have so many baits, but I usually only take like one box with me.
It usually depends
on the time of the year and where I'm fishing.
I don't need you showing up with a U-Haul. Yeah.
No, right. I mean, I could.
Yeah, I know.
That's exactly it. So I was just thinking about this the other day. It's like, okay, so I'm going down there at the end of January. What am I going to need? Mm-hmm. And, I was kind of thinking about it and my initial thoughts are I'm going to take some for the most part, I might take some bigger baits. I will bring smaller stuff, but I want stuff that's moving slower. That's more neutral, buoyant. It's not moving, you know, rising super fast or even falling super fast. Just because I think the water's going to be colder and, you know, the fish are just going to be more lethargic. So I was thinking I'm going to bring some rubber, specifically, I might even try throwing like some toads this year just because I know their sink rate is a little bit different than bulldogs and medusas. And I have some bigger ones that are shallow. I have some bigger ones that run deep. I have, you know, smaller ones that run deep and shallow. So just try, you know, different stuff like that. Suex, I mean, in the winter, slow moving, even if you throw some weights on them. Sandcats are a new thing that kind of came out. I'm kind of big on those baits. I like those baits a lot. So I'll take some of those. I don't think I'm going to be bringing much top water, even though I love top water, one of my favorite baits, but I don't think I'm going to be bringing much of that.
I've seen it happen though. I've caught a top water fish every month of the year.
Really?
Okay. I have. Now, mind you, I wasn't like burning it in. But you'll have them on those fish will surface. One thing too, so people that are listening understand, when we're talking cold water temp down here, though, we're talking 50.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we're not talking even late fall temps up here, yeah.
No. And one thing, too, about the seasonality, something I'm always trying to convey about the South is if you're a northern muskie fisherman, let's say that you know, you live in Wisconsin, you live in Madison, and the vast majority of your time has been spent fishing Wisconsin, fishing Minnesota. What is happening with the muskies in October up there is diametrically opposed to what's happening with the muskies in October here.
Oh yeah, weather. I mean, right. The water.
You got to.
I think you're like, we kind of were thinking about it and figuring it out. We thought that down there, as far as like in the spring, You guys are probably spawning a month and a half of what we were up here is kind of what we were thinking.
Well, that's a move. I'll say this. That's a moving target at times when going to spawn. Yes. But the thing to think about, I think the big takeaway would be that don't apply conventional knowledge because of what the calendar says.
Right.
You know,
no.
Let's say if you're down here in the fall or something like that and you go, man, it's October. October in the South, in Tennessee, West Virginia, Kentucky, some of these other places, the last thing on my mind is slow moving rubber and a sucker hanging off the boat.
Right.
October here is, man, I hope to God my wrist doesn't hurt because I'm about to burn this stuff. You know, it turns into some of the October conditions can be reminiscent of the kind of activity levels you can see in July up north. So that's the thing just to consider that, hey, just what they don't look at the what month the calendar says. Look at the conditions and go, okay, it's 65, 75 degrees. The water temperatures are telling a way different story. And I think, you know, anywhere you go in the South outside of that sort of your comfort zone from fishing up north, that can get you in trouble. And it's just something to consider is just take it for what it is and don't try to apply the month to the fish. Another thing, though, that to talk about, there's not many, if we look at musky fishermen in general, not many of us get to fish in July and February or January and February, excuse me. And,
no.
And it's a whole different world. Some of the patterns you and I have experienced together and stuff I've seen is not really in the books. You know, it's not.
Yeah. I think the one time you said something, you're like, yeah, I'm fishing the river channel on the giant lake, in 60 feet of water, throwing a shallow raider. Or something, and you were catching fish, and me and Spencer were down there. We're like, "Is this guy crazy? Like, what?
What?
Really? You're in 60 feet of water in the middle of the river channel, essentially, anyway, of this huge reservoir, throwing a shallow rider that goes down, you know, 5 feet. It's like,
yeah, well, you know, you got to figure it out day to day, and I know that's a pattern. That's a pattern that I deal with fish that will be suspended in the upper water column." During a period of time most considered to be winter, and they're gorging on pelagic fish, you know, and you get into patterns that are reminiscent. I'm not the most well-versed on Wisconsin fishing, but, you know, I hear quite a bit about fishing bait schools in the fall, right?
Yeah, I was actually just going to make a comment about that earlier. So I mean, that's the biggest thing.
Right.
Look for bait.
Right. What these people pursuing muskies on pelagic bait schools are doing in the fall is just what we're doing in January. It's just, you just go, well, just because it's January doesn't mean they're going to be something different, but that you'll have patterns like that emerge. We go, you know, they're not down there with their calendar going, well, it says right here what I should be doing.
I'm just, you know, when you're telling me that pattern, when I'm thinking about fishing that kind of water, the first thing that comes to my mind is more like jigging a Bondi down towards the bottom and you're fishing, you know, up in 6 feet. And it's just like, you know, that's just twitching. Something that's like, dang, you know, if I'm fishing deep up here, a lot of times I'm not fishing that first 6 feet of the deep water.
That's one thing, you know, that just brings up a general point though, too. Is and regardless if you're in the South or in your Canada, because I can take you on Eagle and show you 50, 60 feet of water in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
Just because you're over deep water doesn't mean the muskies will be deep.
Right.
And that's one thing I think is something that is lost on a lot of people. They think if I'm positioned over deep water, it is now the only thing that I can do is throw deep baits. Now, the conventional knowledge will tell you that, let's say we have a school of crappie or we have a school of shad, the muskie will set beneath them and come up and feed on them and stuff like that. That happens, but at times you'll get, you know, the bait school is so high that the muskies are within, you know, shallow raider range. They're within bucktail range. You know, it doesn't have to be a deep bait school But also, too, on the same token, in the winter, it's not like the bait school's busting on the surface by any means, but just, right. just probing that. And that's just something in general, I think, too, and that point also comes to play in trolling. Something to point out is people, they immediately think if, like, I'm in 40 feet of water, I've got to be running my baits deep. I'm plowing through this place. I'm going to dredge the bottom.
Well, if I'm running only one line, I mean, I personally, like, I am more confident running something that runs. If I'm in 40, I'm going to run something that runs 20. If I can run two lines, I'll run a shallow raider, a depth raider kind of thing and cover mm-hmm. that, you know,
right,
that
right.
20, 12 feet and then the six, you know, 8 feet.
Yeah, just but you know, the thing I would just, the point is, like you said, if you have the options or play with it, if you can only troll one line, make two passes, though, because
right.
you'll find those fish that are, they're hanging out over deep water. They're not in deep water. And I think that's right. just the point being, just because they're over it, they're not in it. And I sort of try to remind myself constantly, the adage I hearken back to is, muskies are a shallow water, a low light shallow water predator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is what I try to always remember. They want a lighting advantage. They want to be able to see. But in general, you know, don't hold my feet to the fire here. But they right. like being shallow. You know, it's not all the time. It's not every body of water. But I use that thing. I just tell myself that on occasion just to refocus, because I've had days where, you know, I not listening to my own advice, and I've gone out there and drug baits at 20 feet all day long. You know, and just
right.
ticking and clicking. And just to keep that in mind, and like you said with that pattern, you know, the open water casting patterns, that's one thing I would tell or encourage anyone that's going to try to pursue muskies in the South, at least have some confidence in not casting directly to cover. And,
okay, right, yep.
you know, that I think there's a comfort level that comes from, I'm looking at a stump, or I'm looking at a weed line, or I'm looking at some kind of element that is visually, I can visually see it, and I'm going to land my lure near it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where at times, if fish are on break lines, they might not be on the break line that's conveniently located by the shore. They might be on a break line that's coming off an adjacent flat. They might be on a river channel, and your boat is out in open water. And, you know, you're 400 yards from the nearest shoreline.
Right.
And it right. harkens back. Everything's cyclical. But it comes back to what I was talking about, structure fishing. And that's just the thing of maybe you might not consider yourself a structure fisherman, but having some of that comfort in, I'm going to park my boat out in what seems like open water. You know, and I don't know why. And you and I have talked about this, and it's something you've really been building over the last few years. Is breaking out of that comfort zone where I might be missing a really substantial bite, and all I have to do is come off that shoreline 100 yards.
Yep.
And you know, just with everything, we're just always trying to up our game. So if you're going to come down here and do that, have that in mind, you know, because there's plenty of days where the fish are not up in the stumps or in the weeds or in the break lines or conveniently located. You know,
I mean, honestly, what I started doing is I don't even necessarily worry so much about my depth anymore. I look for bait, and wherever the bait is, that's where I'm going to start fishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if I'm not finding a lot of bait out deep, then my assumption is that it's in the shallower weeds, you know, where obviously you can't see it as well when it's in the weeds. But
yeah, I mean, that's what you said just gets what you said transcends geographical location or season.
Oh yeah, everywhere. Bait fish will tell you where the muskies are. They're the predators.
Absolutely.
They have to be feeding on something.
Right.
Now, you might find the wrong bait. Like, they might be feeding on, say, down there, shad instead of the crappies.
Right.
And you might find a school of crappies, and you're fishing the wrong bait, you know, for
right.
the time of year. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's about, they have to eat. So it's,
right.
and if you're catching them, you're catching feeding fish typically. I mean, so.
Right, right. And I mean, yeah, you could sit here and we could both wax eloquent about catching negative and neutral fish, but
yeah. Well, right, yeah, no, but for the most part, I mean,
I've wasted a billion hours of my life trying to lure fish in that really just don't give a rat's. You know, they don't want to eat. You know, and you sit here and go, I would rather find a fish that's actively feeding because he's going to end up in the net. And like you said, that just transcends everything. If you're looking for active muskies, look for fish. Look for bait fish. Look for other fish activities. You know, God, what's that adage? 90% of the fish are using 10% of the lake. You know,
yeah,
I don't know if
it's totally true.
I don't know if it's statistically 100% accurate, but it feels like it a lot of times. And it's like, how many times have you been fishing for any species? You spot jump, spot jump, spot jump. You end up on the right spot, and it's like you can do no wrong. You know, and I see people that's so true in like walleye fishing and bass fishing. You know?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, there's times everything for some reason is on the north end of the lake. And
right.
I mean, the south end might typically have better structure, but maybe it's because of the wind or something. And everything's on that north end, even though there's not as much structure. You know, it's just where the fish are.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, just for your fishing in general, you know, I'm not, admittedly, I can't tell you the last time I ever left the house to fish for anything other than muskie, but I know, you know, being here in the South, bass is king, you know, largemouth bass. And the commonality that I find when I talk to, and I'm talking professional grade, serious bass anglers, the commonality between all of them is they are not fishing spots unless there's bait on it.
Oh, yeah.
They're not going to roll in. And I feel like musky anglers, we do this all the time. Just because it looks, I'm going in there because it looks good. And mind you, don't get mad. I've caught a disproportionate number of fish on a hunch and going, well, that looks good. I ought to throw a cast over there. You know, it's not.
Oh, absolutely.
Not because I knew
anything.
If
it looks good, it is. I mean, if it looks good, a lot of times it is. There are times it's not, though, too.
But so. I've been on boats and trips where we're going into places. And in the summer, in summer peak, and there's not a minnow breaking the surface. There's no bug activity. There's nothing. It's a dead zone, and nothing happens. You know, I'm never shocked. You know, I'm never sitting here going, well, I expected something to happen. And what you brought up about locating bait is just such a transcendent point of focus your energy where there is bait. Focus your energy on places that are holding fish. Period. And that's the advent of modern electronics obviously solves that problem, which we could be doing a 7.5-hour podcast if we get into like the minutiae of electronics and things of that nature and how to use those tools. But, you know, you just hit it on the head. Whereas if you're coming down south or you're going up north, doesn't matter. Focus on finding the bait. The muskies will be there. As you astutely said, they're not going to be in places that there's not a predatory advantage. You know, and I think a lot of times that when you're confronted by a new place, let's say you roll down in Tennessee, you roll up somewhere new, you're focused entirely on those shoreline elements. It goes back to what I was talking about, looking for coves, looking for familiarity.
It's just easy. That's what it is.
Easy.
I mean, everyone wants to resort to what's easiest. I mean, of course, if I can catch fish throwing top water and blades as opposed to ripping big rubber, you know, I would much rather catch fish throwing top water and blades, you know?
Right. Oh, absolutely.
If you can catch them fishing shoreline, I mean, that typically is, I feel, what most of your musky anglers start fishing when they fish a place first, is a lot of times it's a shoreline that they think looks good, whether it be because there's a deep break there or, you know, there's a creek mouth or there's some weeds, whatever. Typically, a lot of times it is shoreline, and it doesn't always pan out.
Right.
But the thing is, if it does, it's the easiest thing. So why not try it first?
Well, try it first. But, I mean, talked about Buck Perry earlier, and we're totally off the southern tip, and we're into more general things, and I like it. But we're talking about structure fishing, and I remember there's some old videos of Buck Perry fumbling around on YouTube. If you don't know Buck Perry is about as southern as it gets, just a real rascal kind of guy, I would call it, but he's smart as a whip. And long before we had sonar or any electronic devices, he was figuring out trolling. He wasn't a musky fisherman, he was a bass fisherman, but really delved into those structural elements, how they worked, why the fish use them. But like you said, if you watched him fish, here's this master troller, and his first thing is check shallow. And that's everybody. I do the same stuff. I'm not sitting here on the podcast going, I go out and look for pelagic bait schools off the bat.
Right. No,
you know, I'm not that guy. Let's not, don't get misconstrued that I'm going out. I'm forget you losers. I'm going out here in 60 feet of water. If you see
if you're struggling, I mean, that's what I think you resort to,
those elements, but you know, obviously there's nothing wrong. Here's these legendary anglers checking that. But also too, what I'm getting at with Buck is if you watch the way he did and he worked it out, was check shallow, check medium, and then we go deep. And I think as musky anglers, a lot of times, because it is a war of attrition, it is a game of just beating it, we get caught in that thing where it's from sunrise to sunset, we fish the same stuff.
That's why I like going to new places, because if I fish the same stuff over and over and over, and that's the advantage of up here versus down south. I mean, we have 1,300 lakes in Vilas County alone, and probably 80% of them have muskies, you know?
I've got 13 in Tennessee.
And I mean, that's the whole state, and you're driving, you know, all over. So that is the one, you know, one good thing about up here is there's so many different things. Down there, it's just the big body of water with all of the stuff, you know.
Right. It's not a matter of, you know, you can trailer and go places, but like you said, we've got, it's not that we lack any surface area of water. It's just in one big pond, baby. And, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah. You have all the, like, I mean, there's certain lakes I go to fish up here if I want to fish rocks or certain weed lines or, you know, deep areas. Like, there's certain lakes I go for that. Whereas down there, that's just certain areas. It's all one lake, and it has all that structure. But it's not a different actual body of water. It's literally just a different spot. And actually, at sometimes that might even be an advantage because you don't have to leave one body of water to fish all the different structures.
Right. And I think what we're getting out of anything, the takeaway from this, the whole discussion would be, if you're going to come down here and you're going to come to the South, you're going to go to Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, any of these places, be prepared to break out of your comfort zone. I mean, it's like the article that's out. I think I close it with that is the key to fishing. And forget Southern. Forget what I just said about if you're coming down here. If you're going anywhere, just musky fishing in general, just be prepared to do it all. And that's probably my biggest thing that I see these guys that are just legends in the sport. You know, I've been fortunate enough to spend time with Joe on his boat. And here's this guy, and I'll put in perspective. Here's this guy that fishes only his own baits, right?
He obviously fishes all sorts of stuff. I mean, he's got baits that run at all different levels.
Right, but he's got his baits, right? We all know the Joe Bucher bait line, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not once is he grabbing another bait. Me and you are tackle addicts, you know.
Don't get it wrong.
Joe's got a ton of baits, but they're all shallow raider in three different sizes: baby depth raider, suspending depth raider. You know, he's got the tools, but so he's even more limited than your average musky fisherman on what baits he has. And this guy catches a tremendous amount of big fish on highly pressured bodies of water. And the one thing I'd say is this. So we've eliminated the fact that he has magical baits. He doesn't. You know, me and Tyler rummaging through his tackle boxes, you know, there's no magical baits. There's no magical spots. The difference is he does it all. And that's what I'm trying to give. That's what I'm trying to learn myself. I'm a consummate student here. You know, it's cathartic doing the podcast because I get to learn from people like you and all these people talking about these things. But the takeaway being is this, is here's this guy with limited tackle. It's not like he can go grab this or grab that. But I've seen him in action where he's willing to do it all. He's willing to fish deep. He's willing to fish shallow. He's willing to fish mid-depth. He's willing to fish slow. He's willing to fish fast. He's willing to do it all until the fish answer the question, what do they want?
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't fail on the water. You learn. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's the thing. I can go out there and not catch a fish all day And I can still have confidence because it's like, okay, well, I learned what the fish might not be doing. So now I can narrow it down to what they might be doing.
Yeah. And that's,
I mean, that's where it's helpful to, you know, if you are going to a new place, especially a southern reservoir that's so big, I mean, taking a week definitely is beneficial. I mean, if you haven't been there before.
Or take a guide, Steve Paul.
I was going to say, Mr. State record holder down there. One of what? There's 28 states that have muskies now or something. So you're one of 28 in the country.
Whoop-dee-doo.
How does that make you feel? One of the top 28 muskie anglers in the country, technically.
Oh, whatever. God. Listen, that stupid crap. Got a hat in the mail, you know? That's about it. But I'm lucky. I've caught some big fish in my day, but yeah, you embarrass me, Josh, you embarrass me, but yeah.
I agree with Booker. I know you don't like talking about yourself, and I mean, that may be a little over the top, but if you do think about it, I mean, that is true. There are only 28 states or whatever that must be. So technically you're one of 28 in the country that has done something, you know.
Well, whoop-de-doodle. I hope I save some New Year's Day fireworks. I'm going to have a one-man parade, everybody, for me. Now, I don't like talking. I mean, I love muskie fishing. I love talking. I don't like talking about myself, per se, but you are correct. I do have the state record in Tennessee. Big fish caught on a glide raider. Thank you very much. Everybody hates that bait, and you're a dum-dum. If you're not,
I bought a couple. I will say I bought a couple of them. Just
you're not a dumb dumb. See, if you're listening, Josh is not a dumb dumb. If you don't have one, you're a dumb dumb. I'll say this, man, and to steer the conversation away from me, steer it to the glide raider here. That bait, and I've talked about it on the podcast, talked about it in articles. That bait is not meant to take away other gliders out of your arsenal. It's sort of like a tailor-made presentation, and the biggest thing with that is people don't understand the application and the action, you know, and it's just such a sleeper where there's this small cluster of dudes that know what's up with that bait. I can't tell you, I've turned a ton of clients onto that thing, whereas I can get that bait to do things I can't do with other gliders, and two of my biggest fish three. I've got three really big fish on glider raider. I've got a 55, the state
record. Which is bigger than the state record. Yeah. Let's not forget. Yeah. You've caught what? Four bigger than the record now too.
Well, I'm not a muskie. I'm not here to murder muskies. That's another thing.
Right, no, I know.
In my defense. Exactly. Let me put it this way. That fish, the state record fish, liked the glide raider so much, it choked on it. It was just gone down its throat. Long story. It's ugly. I don't even want to go there. But yeah, caught some really big fish on it. And it's just, you know, we're on that subject of glide raider. It's just a killer bait. The one thing I'll tell you, if you're going to try using that bait, is use your reel. You don't really have to put a lot of juju or muscle into that thing. I've watched Joe throw it, and he's sitting there turning his reel more so than anything. It's not a matter and mind you, I'm not sitting here, you know, this is the only bait on the planet.
No, right.
I throw 10-inch phantoms.
I love my phantoms.
Right. I throw sixes, sevens, tens. But when I'm sitting here and looking, I'm looking at glide raider and a 10-inch phantom. There are two different tools. They just don't.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the thing to look at with that bait. You know, I obviously I'm sitting here waxing eloquent about it, but it's worth checking out. It really is. It can do some serious damage for you. And like I said, my pro tip on that one is just don't overwork it. The other thing, little factoid here, I think Chaz did it, might still do it. There are number 7 Mustad triple grip hooks. They're musky size. They're big, 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 big hooks. Best hooks on that bait. You get a better penetrating set with that. It'll make the bait run a little deeper. I know a lot of people don't think it runs deep enough. That's because
It does. I mean, it runs a little shallow, but adding a little weight to it.
Well, the hooks, just the hook weight will get you where you need to be. The other thing with that though, man, and I'm not trying to turn this is the Glide Raider podcast. Not trying to do that, but the trick with that bait is you can quickly, and I've done it, and it's awesome to watch. let's say we're fishing rocks, right? We're up in your neck of the woods and we're fishing a rocky point.
Right.
If I want to get a fish fired up, I will get that thing down there, glide presentation, and then I'll get it on the surface. And it's the only bait that I know that I can get it up and I can work it on the surface like a walk the dog. So now you're talking about you want to fire a fish up and get him not – and with any glider we run into this situation, how many fish have you brought in a glider and they don't strike because you're sort of like, this sucks beside the boat. Sorry. I know there's great tips and stuff. I'm not a great glider figurator. I'll be the first one to admit.
Oh, honestly, I've actually had fish hit it while doing this. I don't even do an eight. I just sit next to the boat and pop my rod tip a couple of times. Just so it goes side to side.
Yeah.
Not necessarily jig. I mean, I'm just kind of pulling it forward with the momentum, you know, of the boat going forward. So it's just dancing side to side. I've had a couple come up and hit it doing that. But, I mean, but figure eighting, it's tough. I mean,
that's my little secret trick, giving away the ghost there on the glide radar, is draw them off that deep structure and then take them to the surface. And they can't stand it. They're going to hit it. If you know where one's at and he won't hit, do that. Glide radar deep, bring him up, get that thing cooking with some gas, big long cast, and you're going to get him. Well, we could sit here, and me and you, and you're going to be on the boat here soon. I know we could talk for like 7 hours here, and we've covered everything from we started talking about Southern Muskie, and now we're talking about glide radars forever. So we've got Ask a Pro questions. You're a total professional, so you're up to the job here. We're going to delve right in. First one is from Jim. Jim says, I've been going to Lake Vermilion in Minnesota in early June for the last 8 years. It's a great musky lake, but I normally fish walleye, bass, and crappie. What would be my tactics to find and how to fish these early season beasts? So you're asking, how do I find them early season beasts? I'll say right off the rip, if you know where the crappie are, that's a good start.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, we're talking about finding the bait. And the bait. If you're going up there fishing what is essentially the muskie's bait, you're already probably dang near right in the right spots.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Josh, because you're a little bit – I can't say I've spent too much terrible time up north in June. What are we probably thinking temperature-wise, water temperature in June, Lake Vermilion? Best guess. 60s, 50s, I don't know.
Yeah, probably anywhere from the mid. I mean, I'm thinking up here. I mean, it was crazy 2 years ago, I think, like Memorial Day weekend when season opened. I mean, we had like 90 degree temperatures, like, and the water was up in, you know, the mid 60s within opening weekend.
Right. So it could be anything.
But typically, I think you're looking mid 50s to mid 60s. I wouldn't guess it would be any warmer than that.
Well, I mean, you know, with that in mind and barring, Jim, your question there, barring that you, like you said, you have an exceptionally warm spring or exceptionally cold spring, you know, at that point, I'm thinking, you know, June, a mix of mid-sized stuff and some downsized stuff comes to mind.
I'm throwing small stuff here typically in the shallow weeds, but that's there again, that's where I'm finding the bait, you know, the crappies and stuff. So if you're finding the crappies there in that time, I mean.
Right. And if Jim's been successful on walleye and bass and crappie, you're ahead of the pack because you know the water a little bit. You know what these other predatory fish, crappie are a predator, bass are a predator, walleye are a predator. The apex predator's not going to be too far behind.
Right.
They're not, you know, I could sit here. We could do a 5-hour podcast about muskies I've caught off walleye spots.
Or bass guys who have caught muskies. Right, you know, I hear all the time, I was bass fishing and caught this giant muskie all the time.
We don't like those guys.
If
you're a bass guy and you've caught a big muskie, we don't like you. Throw it back.
It hurts sometimes. Yeah, make sure you throw it back. If you throw it back, it'll hit his back.
Hopefully that bass guy's got the Muskie 360 app and you read the article on how to handle these things. So, all right, moving on swiftly here. Rich says, my super cool wife got me some musky lures for Christmas. Well, congrats to you, Rich. Your wife is actually super cool if she bought you lures for Christmas. And he says, one of them is a Suic. Dun, dun, dun. One's a Suic, and I was wondering if you had any tips on how to use it. Well,
hey, I was gonna say I'll let you take that one since I watched you literally make one eat your suet.
Tell that story. There. You want to talk about me? Let's talk about that one.
All right. Yeah, we're down in Tennessee. It was January. I think this was just last year.
Yeah.
We had already put, I think, 3 fish in the boat. Some nice ones, you know, upper 30s. And then I think I lost one. And then all of a sudden, you know, Steve's throwing a suic over here that he put weights
January,
on.
In mean, January, like a moron.
Rubber banded weights on, by the way.
Don't give away all my secrets.
No, I know. Just rigged up. In only a Stephen Paul way. And I'm watching, and I mean, the water's fairly clear down there, and I'm watching his bait, and I see a suet come down, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh man, Steve, one just missed your bait. And he's like, just wait. And I just watch him. I've never personally executed a dead stick like this, but man, was that crazy. All of a sudden he's like, just watch this. Doesn't move a muscle, and the thing just comes up and inhales it, and Steve hooks it, and next thing you know, we're putting almost a 4-foot, probably 28-pound fish in the boat.
Yeah, you know, I've got a trick or two up my sleeve. So, yeah. Rich, your question with suics, practice. And I hate to say that. I'm not trying to be like practice. The one thing I'll say is this. My wife bought me some musky lures for Christmas, and she got me one of these suic high impacts, the plastic ones.
Yeah.
I played with it the other day. It runs great. And the thing I would say is this, I don't know if she got to the plastic ones, but you could always go sneak one in there because she already sees you have suic, so get a plastic one. You don't have to tune them as much. I realize that. I've got a whole article on Musky 360 under Musky Lures about how to tune suics, how to modify them, what to do to get them to run right. But
that's one of the toughest things it with is. Suic. And modifying them, dude, playing with them.
You've seen like mine look like they've been through a wood chipper, and I don't switch them out because those run. I'm sitting there. And each bait is just different. It's a stick of cedar wood. So you can have a knot in one and it's going to run like crap, and you get another one and it runs like gold. So you don't know. I'll tell you, Rich, I'm not trying to give you a straightforward answer on that, but you're going to have to play with it. I've got the whole article here on the app talking about the things that I do to get suics to run the way I want them to, which delves into reweighting. The other thing I think I put in the article, you're talking about rubber bands. Everybody hates fishing suics because if you screw it up a little bit, you can get that hook around the leader. Man, grab you some little rubber bands people use on like braces, or they use on as hair ties, and wrap those hooks up. Josh, you can attest, it doesn't diminish the hooking ratio.
I watched the biggest fish of the trip get caught on it.
Right. So. It keeps those hooks from getting fouled on each other. That's one thing I'd recommend is that. And like I said, just you've got to play with that bait. The problem with this is not having a good, clear picture of what it should look like in the water. Your basic suic action is you're going to give that thing like a 2-3 foot pull with your rod. It's going to dive down and it's just going to rise back up. It's not as if it's doing like backflips, cartwheels or something just miraculous. So it's not maybe the most exciting action you've ever seen. I think a lot of people will pull a suic out of the package and go, this doesn't do anything. And so that's the thing. Don't expect like some insane action. It's a very simple bait. But check out that article under Musky Lures here on the Musky 360 app. It'll get you set on the right path there. Next up is Austin. Austin says, since the St. Lawrence, whoa, all right, this is going to be tough. I've never fished the St. Lawrence. Have you?
I have not. Right. It's been on the list for a while.
It's on the list, so we're right there with you. But there, I just read St. Lawrence. He says, since the St. Lawrence River is huge and is river-like in some parts and lake-like in others, where would you start to target muskie if you're casting in such a large system? Also, how long do you typically stick around and cast on big fish spots? Wow. Okay. One thing I'll say is this, Josh. We just here. I don't get skittish on me now. Is we just talked about coming down south, and how the how it can feel enormous. The St. Lawrence is going to feel probably way bigger than here. You know, it's going to be shocking. Yeah. So some of the same stuff we just talked about in the podcast, Austin, about breaking things down into small pieces. You know, and spending time cruising looking for bait. and just sort of not letting the size of it get to you. As far as parts that are lake-like, river-like, without putting my foot in my mouth and being a dumb, I would say that's going to be seasonal. You know, everything and everything I'm trying to give you, Austin, is anecdotal because I've not fished there. Josh hasn't fished there. If we get somebody on the podcast that has, I will re-answer the question. But the thing I'd say to get you started on the right path is breaking it down structurally, breaking it down by water temp, and breaking it down where the bait is. Because the commonality, like we were just saying during the regular podcast, the commonality is going to be bait. So if you have big expanses of river that are not holding musky forage, that's not where I'd spend my time. The one thing we can address is, how long do you typically stay around and cast on big fish spots?
Yeah. Josh, you know it's a big fish spot?
Well, let's
say
talking
about Gilligan's Point, you know?
Yeah, Gilligan's Point. Let's say he's got a big fish spot.
I thought that was a big fish spot. Typically,
you don't have to stick around because you catch them first cast, right?
No, it doesn't quite work that way. But definitely, I mean, it's not necessarily about pounding the spot. It's more so usually about hitting it at the right times. So
checking your moon phase. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Full moon, new moon, and then the moon cycles within those days are typically, I mean, you know, 3 days before, 3 days after are typically the best. So go, if you do have that big fish spot and you know there's a big fish sitting on it, I'd recommend fishing those times. Necessarily. I mean, I'm not going to go pound one spot all day long, but if I see that big fish and I know it's there, I'm going to go fish it during the prime times of the day.
And
I even go fish for three smaller ones, I may have seen, you know.
The one thing I would say too, he's, you know, with him saying how long he's going to stay around, my rule of thumb is going to be this. And I remember hearing this as a kid, don't educate him. Meaning that if you move to fish sitting there and showing him everything you got in the box. So my rule of thumb is this. Let's say I'm in a big fish spot and let's say scenario A, I don't know if there's a fish on it, but it looks good, right?
Right.
I'm going to fish it with at least two presentations thoroughly.
Right.
And then
I typically won't make more than three passes. I might make three passes at one spot, but I typically won't give it a fourth. I mean, third time's the charm. If it don't pay off that time, go hit it. Yeah, go somewhere else. Go hit it at prime time.
And I think with the way you're saying that on that third pass, that's when you're by yourself. You know,
if you have two people, you can give them two different presentations. And if you're making two passes, you're talking four different presentations possibly.
Just hit it. And then come back. If it's a big fish spot, being like Josh said, coming back, checking the moon phase on Musky 360 and going, hey, it's moon overhead, time to hit that spot. The other point I would make as far as in regards to how long to stay around is don't pound that thing all day long. And I've seen guys do it. I've been in Canada. I've watched guys ruin, you know, here's their one big trip to Canada and you see them in the same cove for 7 days in a row because they moved a 4-footer.
Oh, whoa. We go up there with a group of people and we'll see some really nice fish. And I mean, we might make two passes at the spot and then, you know, we'll go somewhere else. And then, I mean, I know for instance, I had a nice one, 47 incher, missed me in the figure eight, you know, and we took two passes around and it didn't ever eat again or anything. So we left and came back prime time right around sunset and
get him.
I was throw the same bait and it hit out and I mean, smoked it, you know,
I think what we're me and you are both coming to the same juncture is don't bludgeon it. Do a thorough pass on it. If you're by yourself, up to three passes, multiple baits. If nothing's happening, get out of there. Come back under your prime times. There you go. And what's amazing is if you know there's a big fish on that spot, get off of it and go find another one, you know, and come back to him. Don't ruin your fishing day or your trip concerned with a singular spot or a fish. All right. Charlie says, do you have any tips on using electronics? What am I looking for when I'm searching for bait fish? Wow. Well, I didn't look at the questions before this podcast, and that one just hits right on the mark for what we've been talking about for your southern reservoirs. What I'm looking for is I'm looking for large densities of bait fish. We need to do something. I'll definitely have some stuff here on the app here shortly about actual like on screen demos, because we're getting a lot of requests for people like, what are bait fish? What is this fish? What is that fish? What I'm looking for are briefly, before we're not going to go crazy with this one, but what I'm looking for are bait fish that are in the higher part of the water column. They're easy to cast if I'm casting, and I'm looking for a large amount of them. Now that's going to vary.
Yeah, dense. Yep.
Yeah, that's going to vary everywhere you go. I've seen days where here's like there's bait fish and there's smaller fish and they're stratified through every inch of the water column. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a grouping of bait fish that I would consider to be a temporary structural element, almost, right?
Where it's strength in numbers. So if they're balled up and more dense, in theory, it's because they're scared of a predator underneath them. If they're stratified everywhere, yeah, there's nothing happening. They're not scared of anything.
They're not scared. And so that's
Want that strength in numbers bait ball.
Right, right. And then that becomes, like I said, a temporary structure that you're going, they're over there, we can cast that, you know, stay on top of them and all that stuff. So we're just looking for, like you said, strength in numbers, something that's predominant enough to attract a large predator. And like you said, if they're balled up and it's dense, there's more likely that there's a predator around. All right, next one up. Joseph says, I am not great with a bait caster. What tips can you give an old dog to learn some new tricks? None of us, Joseph, none of us are good with a bait caster, buddy. I'm sorry. I'm a professional guy. I still get bird's nest. So if you get bird's nesting, that's a thing. I mean, off the top of my head, man, first thing for that is find the reel that works with your hand. I know that sounds stupid.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, it's unfortunate a lot of times, too, because – I mean, unless you have buddies who have a bunch of different reels that you could possibly just throw a couple casts with, I mean, you can't really try a reel out before you buy it.
Well,
I mean, you can feel how it fits in your hand, but at the end of the day, I mean, I've had some reels where it's like, man, these things are huge, but it ends up being one of my favorite reels. Or, man, this thing is really, really small, and it fits in my hand really nice, but then I don't like how it performs, you know, with something else, casting or the drag or something. Right. So,
I mean, I went through that with some of these. Not to name names of brands or anything, but went something similar. Yeah, I tried some of the super reels this year, and I'm boring. I fish a Boo Garcia 6501s.
I'm a
left-hander. I look like everybody's grandpa out there musky fishing.
I mean, but, I tried a bunch of different stuff. I bought a 13 reel this year. I have a couple of Shimano's. I have a couple of Boo Garcias. And, I mean, I use them all for different things, too. Yeah. So.
Yeah, the thing is this. So find the reel that feels good in your hand. I think what we're getting at is being able to palm it or however you want to hold it that's comfortable. And the biggest thing that I've noticed, and I just innately with an Abu, it feels right for me, is just that it feels natural that you're going to be able to ride that spool. And the reason we're talking about the size of the reel, that it fits in your hand, so it's not like you're trying to cognizantly think about doing what you need to do to cast. It should be second nature. So having the right reel that fits in your hand, number one. As far as if you're just having general casting issues, obviously I'm thinking backlash, I'm thinking distance.
The drag too. Most of the reels have the casting drag. The resistance that you can turn up.
The things that'll get people is they're not riding the spool in an appropriate manner. And so they've got the casting drag cranks so far down that they're casting 12 feet. You know, they got.
I can tell you, I'm personally a victim of that. I turn all mine all the way down, and I run into problems in two situations. I mean, I've done it so much that it's second nature.
Right.
But I get my backlashes in two conditions. One, when I'm trying to throw the bait too far and too hard. And then the other time, typically this goes along with that, is throwing bucktails into the wind. Oh, my goodness, is that a nightmare?
Absolutely. Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, sorry, it popped real loud. But, yeah, throwing anything in the wind, cranks, bucks, and stuff like that. So I guess that, Joseph, the best answer is Don't cast into the wind.
Baits that cut through it better.
The thing I'll say anymore, and I do this all the time, I've got tons of spinning gear on the boat. If you don't like bait casters, guess what? Fish with a spinning reel. I'm so sick.
Oh, yeah, get a bigger one, throw some 60-pound braid on.
And be done with it. I see guys struggle all the time, trying to use bait casters and saying, why? Why are we doing this? Why are you struggling with this when we're spending 30% of our day focused on how the reel and rod is functioning opposed to catching fish? So if it's a big struggle for you, there's a lot of good musky spinning stuff. One of our great sponsors, the Musky Shop, sells spinning rods and spinning tackle that are tailor-made for musky fishing. So that's going to be a big option for you. Josh, we have been talking for way too long. So we're going to wrap up the podcast. If you don't know Josh Krieger is the owner and guide at Wall Hanger Guide Service in Wisconsin. Josh, what's your phone number if somebody wants to book a trip this summer?
Phone number is 262-707-5771. I also have a Facebook page up, Wall Hanger Guide Service, and am currently in the midst of making a website. We are working on getting that going.
Hey, hey. So reach out to Josh if you want to come fish in the South. I'm a dumb, but I'll take you. But no, in honesty, it's Stephen Paul. My website is TennesseeMuskyFishing.com. Spell it out, Google it, you'll find me. But I hope we enlightened you guys on some of the difference in fishing in the South. Hope we answer your questions. We'll talk to you again soon. Josh will be on the podcast again soon. Talk to you later, folks.
The Musky 360 Podcast is brought to you by Yeti, built for the wild. Evinrude E-Tech Outboards, Joe Bucher Outdoors, the number one name in big fish products, and the Musky Shop.